Hello, everybody, and welcome back to QU Podcast. I am your host, Wyatt Randolph, joined today with my very special guest,
John Maynard.
John Maynard, we are here for a sort of a class spotlight. So we're going to be drawing attention to a class that we are taking and we are currently enjoying, and just give everybody the rundown of what to expect in it, our thoughts on it, and some of the important and dramatic parts that we've seen so far. So, but we'll get right into that a little later. First, let's talk about our little love of Ireland we've discovered in class. You seem to be very passionate about the subject, as like you know, our right. teacher and I am. So, how did you get first interested in the Irish culture and history?
Well, my mom's half of the family was Germanic and Irish, mostly Irish, and I didn't really learn much about it till I was like maybe 13 years old, and I had a family friend that introduced me to Irish music, more notably Flogging Molly.
Yeah,
you know, Irish American man I still hold dear to my heart today, and I kind of went from there, so I did more research, the food and cuisine, and then being a huge music nerd.
Yeah,
I kind of got into it pretty deep. Learned a lot about how country music today is derivative to the Irish music or folk music back then.
Yeah.
With more notable examples would be Johnny Cash.
Yeah, very like sad ballads, but always a lively tune.
Right, because you see different examples like something gothic. Even today, you can still see like Celtic punk is still evolving. A lot of bands even now still talk about Irish troubles in the past, but revamped in different, you know, like I guess you could say remixes of the story.
Yeah, it's so interesting how much you can learn from the music of a culture, in Ireland especially, because, you know, I'm not like a heavy researcher when it comes to history. I enjoy it. Like I'll constantly be looking up YouTube videos and trying to learn, but I never like seek out just random stuff on my own. It usually comes to me. And so, like, I didn't directly want to get into Irish culture, like, or Irish history. But a few years ago, I started listening to the music. And I started just learning stuff from there, because there are bands that are so, like, I don't know if patriarch's the right word. We talk about Irish nationalism, where they are so prideful for their country and for freedom, that they have so many songs that just bash the British, talk about Irish freedom to this day, and it's still praising the people who fought in all throughout Irish history.
You know, a lot of even this music, like with pulp culture, we recently talked about, a lot of the bands and music kind of came birth from that, you know, congregation of people, ideas, celebration of life and death. That's where you get different types of food, like bar food and your drinks, you know. A little flavor up there, and depending on the southern end, it'd be like Tullamore do. It's interesting to note that even today, you still see that. I mean, although there's a decline in the future generations, like the younger, like our age and younger, they still honor that tradition even then.
Yeah.
And what I find more fascinating is, no matter what band from like what era, like from the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, or from the 50s, 60s, they each had their own story about what happened in the past.
Yeah.
And that's what I like the most. And it's not always like downbeat or upbeat.
Yeah, there's always a variety. Yes, variety. Of course. But the story is what's important.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very, it's very strong, like, connection with that history, which is, you don't really see in a lot of other cultures. Like, in a lot of cultures, you'll see it based on war ballads or something like that, because that's when the public of that country feels that they're most them. But it's so ingrained in the Irish culture to be downtrodden and oppressed and going through trouble that it seems to be the overarching, you know, background theme. But then there's also this kind of hardiness and joy that kind of pushes through, and you can see that too.
Right. They're very, I want to say something but strong, like passionate.
Passionate, yeah. Passionate pessimist.
Yeah. Even not just in music or baking or cooking.
Yeah.
Just like the trade skills, like you have the shipwrights, you get the shipyards, you have the carpentry, you've got people making clothing, you've got the weavers. And even when it came out of America, you had a lot of them who worked on the high rises and the skyscrapers, welding,
yeah,
doing a lot of metal fabrication. Even that was like the early, like 1910s, 20s, and 30s here in America. Even before then, when they moved out west, they were facing a lot of discrimination.
The railroads. The
railroads. Like, maybe for an example, on the, not the Pacific, but the other one, I forgot what the name of it was, the
Transcontinental Railroad, or what are you talking about?
Oh, that was named the railroad, but there was two companies that did a co-op.
Oh.
The Pacific Railroad Company was started in California. That was more...
It was to connect in the middle? Is that what you're talking about?
That was on Pikes Peak.
Yeah. I couldn't name them. I'm sorry.
But no, that's fine. But I can't...
I understand what you're talking about. Yeah.
It's because the Pacific side, when they made Pikes Peak, they met a lot of issues, like mountains, obviously. And there were a lot of mountains and ice and snow and bears and everything else. And that's more like Chinese dominated. But the Irish actually kind of helped on the eastern side. And so they had, like, a lot of track to lay down. And I believe, if I remember correctly, at Pikes Peak, they had two spike pins and two gold pins as a memorial. And then near that was the celebration of, like, the immigrants, usually the Irish, Irish, Scots, Scot-Irish, and the Chinese who helped along the way. But they were very passionate people.
Yeah.
Along the way, these boom towns started operating from these railways. Met a lot of discrimination and a lot of signs that Irish need not apply. And regardless of what adversity they met, they still look optimistic.
Yeah.
I mean, they drank a lot too, so that might, might help.
We learned recently from class that that is ingrained in Irish culture due to oppression. There wasn't much to do at a certain point in Irish history except drink, because that's where you would socialize and forget your worries. And it became such a big part of their culture that even today it's a staple. If you're Irish, your life is in, your social life is in the bar. Like that, mm-hmm. I think that was a quote from class. And it's such a strange thing to somebody growing up in the U.S. Like I mentioned to you in class that I grew up Southern Baptist, and so you don't grow up seeing a lot of people drink. You see it as kind of a never a good choice, almost. Like that's what you're mm-hmm. taught. But then when you grow up and you gain your own perspective on things, you can kind of see that it can be used as a fun social gathering, like a way to connect with people. And if it's so ingrained in your culture, like I don't see anything wrong with that, you know.
Right. Even it's a lot of at least from my experience, I mean, I grew up Southern Baptist in Texas, so, I mean,
yeah.
It was kind of, you are, you aren't, yeah. Especially for my grandparents who weren't really, they were very strict.
Yeah, because I'm not Southern Baptist anymore. Cause,
I'm not either. Yeah. It's
cause I like to dance.
I like to dance.
Footloose, that's, yeah, exactly. You know? It's, as soon as I watch that movie, I'm like, I'm on the wrong team.
I start dancing, right?
Yeah, I got to be where they... Who are the nice Christians? They're labeled the nice ones. Methodists.
not well versed, but
I think they're labeled the nicest of the denominations is mm-hmm. the Methodists, and they're the ones who have like female priests, preaches and stuff like that.
I think so. I'm not entirely sure, but yeah. But you don't really have like a lot of like celebration parties and.
No, definitely not.
But Irish culture, especially like whiskey, is a very prominent drink.
Yeah.
And beer. You don't see people like here getting like, you know, a big jug of beer, a big glass of like an actual glass, like not like a little itty bitty one, like a.
No one gets a pint.
Pint,
yeah,
a pint.
No one gets a full glass of whiskey. No one gets a pint,
right?
But
or you get a whole bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, the Irish have a special party drink called Irish Punch. And yeah. it is just water, whiskey, and sugar. and they say, like, just a bunch of the old Irish men would always just huddle around that the whole night and drink out of it with spoons and ladles.
Sometimes hands.
Yeah, hands. Just dunk their head in and drink. Oh, yeah. It's
having a good time.
It's so fascinating. It's because it's so counter to American culture. Like, you're not, like, when we think of drinking, it can be social.
Mm-hmm.
but it's never a celebration of life kind of thing. Like they incorporate it into their funerals, you know, it's everyday life. Ours, it's like, no, only when we're trying to act debaucherous do we drink. Like whenever we want to go to a bar, whenever we want to drink, that's when we do it. It's not part of the life, you know, it's a decision.
You know, equivocally standing, at least here in America, where we mourn for the dead, we funerals, you dress in black, you pay respects, and then you have like some type of party, not like a drinking party. You might eat out, celebrate, but
it's like it's a wake or like a, and usually people just give like, we'll eat food and then give condolences, but it's always very somber.
But the Irish, they tend to pick up on like they celebrate life in its fullest, so they remember the memories, the good parts, and celebrate that rather than dying and honestly trying to forget that they're physically gone, but they're still within their hearts. Mm-hmm. And within their culture, they firmly believe that if you still remember in their hearts, are they truly gone?
Right.
So,
and we learned just recently that it is due to the death rate over the many years in Ireland that they had to adapt, because it is impossible to stay in a constant state of mourning. So in a way, they discovered a survival tactic to celebrate the life of somebody when they die instead and enjoy themselves, which is very inspiring to me. It's very, it's so resilient. Yeah. in a very poetic way. So I really like that. All right. Now before, we can keep going into the Irish culture, of course, all day. Let's skip a little more into why you decided to be a part of that class. Like, you obviously knew about Irish culture before. What made you want to take this with coffee?
Well, two reasons, really. First of all, Dr. Coffee.
Exactly. Yes.
Love the man. I think he's a well-versed, well-respected professor. And I do generally think a lot of his classes are pretty informative, get to the point about whatever topic is as at hand. He's very thorough. He's very objective too.
Yes.
Especially when he's given us readings and books to look over, analyze. He doesn't tell us, read this and what do you think? No, he tells us why this book might be wrong, why it could be.
Yeah. Yeah. I did notice that when he was introducing the book, The Famine Plot, he talked about what he did right, what he did wrong, and it was very factual. And Coffee has this amazing way of presenting facts in an entertaining way, because no one will understand unless they're in his class. But his cadence of speak is so enthralling. He will take these long pauses, and I don't know if that's on purpose or not, but it is so captivating, because there's a problem I had in like freshman year, where if I had a class in the morning, I was gonna be like half asleep. but my second semester, I had coffee for my first class, and I just remember the first day, I was like, all right, it's got to get used to morning class again, you know, all groggy. And then he started talking, and he would pause and then say something like to the point, and like not super loud, but like very like straight. And you would just, whoa, like it would pop out. And then he'd use humor and random facts. He'd ask sports questions to give people extra credit, you know, and it was so engaging that it became my favorite class, you know. And that energy is still there now in this class. I was so excited when I saw that he was teaching it, that every time it's so like entertaining. It's so and informative. I learned way more in that class than like through those long, drawn-out lectures. Or
exactly. That's why I personally like him. And then how I got into an Irish, like, why that class, because, again, part of my family's Irish. I got German in me, and a little bit, you know, Texan-Mexican in my family as well, on my dad's side.
Yep.
I want to know more than just the top layer. I want to kind of go deep in the roots. Why Ireland today? Why is Northern Ireland a thing? Why you have bands like U2 who made a song called Sunday Bloody Sunday, and why is resentment from both sides is still there today?
And why did they make that song?
U2 was one of those bands from back. They were one of those bands. They weren't like artists or singers. They're more like story songwriters.
Yeah.
Much like Johnny Cash is. Mm-hmm. And they sing like a lot of issues in the world, like South Africa and apartheid. You've got Argentina. You've got Prague Spring. They sang about But Sunday But Sunday was a song about Bloody Sunday in Ireland, when they've had a very bloody, as the name implies, Bloody Sunday, where you have these protests who were in... Derry?
Yeah.
London Derry.
see, I asked you, but I do know the answer. It's there were 13 demonstrators who were shot on Derry Street, mm-hmm. in Derry. And it's very influential to music because the British Empire is very...
secretive.
Secretive and good at pushing the blame onto other people. Yeah. And the fact that the Irish people are like, no, this is important. And everyone is just... like, loves those, like, when, like, that song, you know, it's, like, people love music, and so they are led by music. If somebody like that releases a song, they'll listen.
Right.
And that's a good way to inform people on stuff, especially if it's at the risk of being covered up or being pushed under the rug.
Humanitarian issues like that. I mean, YouTube made a song about that, and that's how it got into the world. Like, it was reported in the news, but it wasn't, like... I mean, the movie Sunday Bloody Sunday was also a great... It was almost like a documentary that reenacted a lot. And it shows the disconnect between Irish people, the Catholics and Protestants, that were segregated into different halves of the city by the British government. When they said paramilitary in, they're trained to go behind enemy lines. They're not trained to handle riots and people.
Yeah,
they're trained to, like, kill, squash down any rebellion or whatever. And... it kind of gave rise to IRA as well.
Yeah, isn't it funny how we were talking about earlier how, I think off air, how America is a little different. But it seems that the English had the same response then as they did when the American Revolution started. An accidental massacre started. Like, that was not, that was definitely, I can definitely see that not being the intention during Bloody Sunday, that I don't think they expected to shoot people, but there was kind of a general, like, feeling of anyone in here could be a terrorist in their mind, and so the violence just started.
The tension just so high, and everything was like just the energy in the air was so charged, and
Then the Boston Massacre, they talk about the same thing, how it was the intensity got out of control, and that's why things started, And you'd think that the British would learn their lesson. Like, that's not the way to deal with people who are agitated. Yeah, like, just give them some space. And because that's all they wanted. We learned recently that they wanted to be part of England, but have, like, autonomous rule at some point. Like, if Britain early on had just realized the value of having an ally so close instead of having a subject, like, right next to them, things could have been totally different. But... we learned from a class that was never going to happen.
Right. That song, it talks about just the whole day. And it's very sad, especially when you watch a movie. You know, it's like a reenactment, almost like a documentary. It kind of gets you in a different place. Not like where innocent people died. Right. But it hits you differently, just how that whole thing portrayed, how it started and how it went.
Yeah.
And even way after that, you know,
yeah, some situations are objectively bad, like, and when people are and where innocent people are harmed, it can really impact people, like, in a very strange way, like, and that's why whenever we see natural disasters or things like that, you see people rally, you know, for support for them. And so I think that's why songs like that, that address intense issues in life, do become so popular, and they are good at spreading the message.
Right.
It's an important part of communication, you know, to get it, information to as many ears as possible. And so when you have artists willing to, you know, sacrifice their reputation with some countries to inform people, that is very brave and very,
respectable.
Yeah. Respectable. Honorable, yeah.
That's why I like YouTube a lot, I think. more songs like Sunday Bloody Sunday would be off the Joshua Tree album. I think there's their best album to date. Mm. And best companion would be that would be Rattle and Hum. Mm. Also get some live performances there. They did a live performance in Dublin as well later on. But yeah, no, it was, they went through a lot. And the fact that they're still, I guess you could say, a form of optimistic about their future and how they interact with people, their kids, and society's built, and especially infrastructure, too, has changed quite drastically.
Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about how the Irish have been oppressed. Let's kind of take it back to the early days of class. Do you think Coffey's use of bringing in another teacher who is familiar on the subject to talk about the Reformation and how that set Ireland on a collision course with England for a long time. Do you think that was a good teaching method? Did you, because I personally liked it a lot because, you know, Coffey can teach perfectly, of course, but when he brought in the gentleman who taught us about it, his name escapes me at the moment, he brought out a, like a printout sheet, you know, that we, and Coffey, when he asked us about it, we couldn't answer all his questions because we didn't understand what he was saying. Because the guy gave us an example of a painting that represented the the Reformation, and none of us knew the name because it wasn't written on there. And Coffey was like, "Were you guys not listening?" Like very passionately. Right. Like I brought him in, and you guys didn't listen. But we knew everything that it was about, but we just didn't know the name
because he didn't mention the name. Yeah. I mean, that painting in particular, like I could tell you about it.
Yeah,
like, one part's like death, one part's life, and
it was a big part of the test. I could tell you a lot about it.
Oh
yeah.
Well, yeah, that's where I spent my time on.
Yeah,
but I did think that was a very good change of pace. Like instead of having him, he brought in someone else that was more informative, more into that field, who specializes in that and tells us specifically why. I mean, if you want to know why Ireland is the way it is today, why we have Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, or Ireland as a whole, is because of the big resentment towards the Catholics and Protestants that they have for each other. And that stemmed from the Protestant Reformation, King Henry VIII, with him defying the church with the Pope.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to divorce his wife to marry Anne Boleyn. At the same time, the Irish didn't want that because they would lose their protection from the crown. Or not from the crown, but from the Pope. And then, you know, Norman Steele and everything else. But that's why. A lot of the problems today stem from that moment. So when he brings up another professor, another high intellectual individual on the matter, he brought more insight on the Reformation than I think I ever had.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Like, he was specific. He was very poised. He was very particular. Like, he was very methodical in explaining some of the different concepts, especially with that painting, and especially with his interpretations of Latin. He did spoke fluent, I'm going to say, at least proficient level Latin, and he brought different phrases, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. No, it was definitely the most informative class I've had on the Reformation, and I didn't even know we would get into that signing up for the class. So it was very interesting, because he focused on the Martin Luther part, and then and then it was Coffey who really drove home the Henry VIII and his reasons for the Reformation and how that affected Ireland forever, and even to this day, you know, it's class modern day Ireland. He was Coffey would tell us how they still celebrate some of these atrocities that they did against each other. Where the, like the Protestants will wear orange and march down the streets, and all the Catholics order, stay home that day,
and then vice versa.
Yeah, it's just because of how, like, it's so weird to see, you know, religious tension in Christians to this day at such a level.
And, right, even to this day, it's still very. I want to say it's not. What's the word? Like, not prominent, but like the newer generations are certain, like, this has been going on long enough, can we just make amends?
Yeah.
And the older generations know we're still going to keep going at it.
Yeah, it's still, you know, there's always these problems that you think we'd outgrow, but we still got a little bit to go, even in this country. So let's talk about our current project in the class. We've been assigned to read The Famine Plot.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
This goes along with everything we've learned in the class already about Ireland and how they've been oppressed by the British since a Irish king asked the Normans, who eventually took over England, for help in a war to conceal power, and then that just mm-hmm. basically gave away their rights. And that continued for years and years, and the Irish didn't even have the rights to their own land. They didn't have say in government until a lot later. They were seen as barbarians. They were depicted
as monkeys.
You know, yes, in
caricatures.
Yeah, in newspapers. The media treated them so poorly that English citizens did not care. You know, and that is very evident in this book.
Yeah. In this book by Timpat Coogan, The Famine Plot is aptly named for the book. He did talk about how they were treated like as almost if they were subhuman, even. And obviously he has a very particular way of saying who's at blame. Spoiler alert, it's the United Kingdom. Yeah. Or not the United Kingdom, Great Britain.
Great Britain.
Yeah. Yes. And he, at the beginning of the book, he gets more numerical, more analytical about numbers and how many people died during the famines, the minor famines of the blights. And it was very heartbreaking when he did bring some real world examples. I remember reading early on in the book, I think it's like the first chapter, maybe even before that, he was talking about how a farmer would stone his neighbor who was a widow because she was taking, I guess, a potato or some other crop from his land. And that kind of sets your mind in a mood and tone at the time that these people were neighbors, friends, family.
Yeah, like family. Parts of the community, but it was so desperate at the
right.
time that so many people died. And it's, even to this day, you know, it's seen as, well, I guess it's debated if it's genocide. And that's what
right.
the book talks about. It gives definitions of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And it from someone, like an activist standpoint, it is. It's very calculated almost because
calculated, yeah.
Because it talks about it later in the book. There's a chapter talking about the equivalent of the media coverage of the famine, and
yeah.
how they spun it eventually. Of even though they didn't do much to help them, they you know it was mostly Quakers and volunteers and things like that who actually gave aid to the Irish. The English started writing after the years went on of trouble, like, this has been going on long enough. Why should we send any more aid or help if they just can't pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Because, the party at the time was all about, you know, government not getting involved. Laissez-faire.
Laissez-faire.
And it's so you can see how calculated it is because in the media they depict it as, this is a burden on the Irish. They obviously have messed up. You know, it's not our place.
Yeah.
And that's the nail in the coffin for me because it is blatant.
Blatant disregard for their lives.
And even just convincing people that they don't matter. That is genocide because in my mind because that potential help is gone. And you can see this propaganda of depicting people like that later in history, like with Germany and things like that, and how they depict the Jews and things in
mm-hmm.
their propaganda. They're made as to see be not human or not important and a kind of a drain on society. And
yeah.
and it you'd think at a time of great destruction and famine, you wouldn't just throw someone under the bus who's starving to death, but that's what happened. And it's hard to see the argument from the other side. This book gives a lot of information, and it's very convincing. And so I think most of us in the class are taking that stance with him on the British are at fault. What mm-hmm. do you think on the as a book as a whole?
As a book as a whole, I generally loved it. It was very it died in different areas than not a lot of people would thought about.
Mm.
There's a lot of different variables. There's a lot of caveats with this.
Yeah.
Especially minor famines. And in the book, Tim was talking about how they were fertilizing the potato crop. Mm-hmm. I forgot the specific strain. I forgot what it's called. It's a big, ugly potato is what he described that.
Big, ugly potato.
Yeah.
Yeah. They switched from manure to guano, which I thought was very intriguing because guano is usually excrement from, like, a seabird or, like, bats, more probably bats.
I'm bats,
like,
yeah.
Don't remember bats being that numerous in Ireland.
Yeah, I never thought about it.
And then seabirds, like, oh, maybe on a coast, but not inland. It's kind of strange, but
so they would collect guano as their fertilizer. Mm-hmm. You're saying? Okay, and then did that help or no?
It helped you more.
It helped better. More. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that that happening. There are many tribes that use guano like it's just a normal material you can have in your hand, and because it is so beneficial with growing things, and you. But, like, when we think about it, it's like, ew. you know, it's bat poop. What?
What?
But, no, in survival scenarios where you need crops to grow, they just start to try anything. And mm-hmm. and that was a resource, apparently.
It was available.
Yeah, I knew bats were a problem in around Western Europe, like, especially in France. Like, they had, like, killer bats, you know, like, the big ones.
Bam, yeah.
But I don't know about Ireland. I know they don't have snakes, so maybe they just have a lot of bats instead.
Bats and apparently seabirds, even inland. It's like, he'd talk about how even they could still see the scars of land. He describes as fingers going up to the hillside where they had these rows of plants where they would plant the potatoes. They would.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. The big communal, like, growth area. Mm-hmm. I forget what they were actually called, but yeah, the way they would farm before the famine was very loose. It was like potato does it itself.
Does what it wants.
Yeah, and it was such a vitamin heavy superfood that they didn't even think of diversifying.
Right.
You know,
it wasn't tasty, but
yeah, they. Well, what did you need? Just needed vitamin
D.
D. Yeah, that was the only supplement you needed. And when you're poor and you don't have a way of advancing, and you can't own land, you can only rent. There's no thought of, you know, getting political office, changing your lot in life, like nothing. No. It's hard to think about like how can we innovate our food system. It's more like this is cheap and available, you know. And so you can see that it was. Someone like the British tried to blame, like, you know, you can blame someone like the Irish for like they only relied on one food source. Well, that wasn't really up to them.
But why was that the situation? You gotta look at there's Thames as a pretty good example. They didn't have the infrastructure like the British had.
No, they did not. No roads. They didn't have roads.
They didn't even have like dirt roads. Yeah. I mean, even like it could be even muddier, slightly dirty, or just like regular plain dust roads. It would still improve. Transportation, like on a coast, you can get fish, barnacles, seaweed, birds, even if they can catch them.
Yeah, Coffey talked about how the Irish didn't fish. They didn't even.
No.
They had so many superstitions about it that the fishermen were actually like the worst fishermen. There was a superstition that fishermen shouldn't learn how to swim, and so it was a dangerous profession.
Yeah. And you got all the sea monsters and all that, too.
And I think it was something to do with. If God wanted you to live, he'd keep you out of the water or something. It's one of those things, and it's like, whoa, that's so dark. But no, they didn't have the preparation. They didn't have the resources the English did. And the English, they got a jump start because of the Romans. Mm-hmm. They didn't even have to build their roads. There was already aqueducts around. You know, they had these things that were set up for them. And then, of course, after the fall of Rome, everything went to the Dark Ages and everything went to ruin, but they still had these relics of the past that they could use, especially when it came to trade and getting resources. Exactly. They continued to steamroll over the Irish, and there wasn't no one helping them. And there was no way that they could develop in this way. And it's very sad.
Right. Because the eastern parts are more fertile lands. They were not in control of. The western was dried, arid, boggy lands. Yeah. Like, you can't plant anything, really, even potatoes. And another issue is, like, they didn't know any better because after you plant, like, say, a potato at the season, that soil, you need to, like, let it aerate, to get fertile again, plant a different crop. They didn't know that. They didn't do rotation. That's also one of their downfalls. But again, how they didn't know any better. They were limited in access of what they could acquire. They didn't weren't allowed to grab carrots or beans or anything like that, or anything that could grow in that climate at that time.
Yeah.
And what's really, the British knew what they were doing. They knew how to help.
Yeah.
Money and food. Instead of like giving money and food, how about you just help build some of their infrastructure, like some of the buildings?
Yeah, there is so much
education
things.
Too.
Yeah, like if they had just seen them as British citizens early on, and they're just like, yeah, who cares about religion? That could have been the best outcome. You know, like how there are memes about the good ending, and then they show like how countries could have turned out. That would have been a good ending, like cooperation. But instead, it is the opposite. And there was one part where it's the reason, this is an accusation at the British, the reason that they didn't help at all, like they saw the potato famine as like God's blessing, because there was an overpopulation problem in Ireland, a problem to the British. It was a problem to the Irish because there wasn't a lot of
there's a lot resources. More mouths to feed, not less food to go around.
Exactly, and there was no since they were all renting, like there's no expansion. It's all you use the resources you have, and when that went away, the British saw it as a blessing because they were like they were obsessed with
depopulizing.
Yeah, we talked about it with Scrooge. He showed that quote in class.
Oh, yes.
I wrote it down somewhere. But he talks about that, how it's like, well, why don't we just, de-inflate the population or something like that? It's because there was a belief back then that the world was getting too populated and we'd run out of resources. Like, this is back, of course, but before the time of innovation, so I can see why everyone believed that. They're like, we can't grow food faster. Right. There's more people, you know, like panicking.
Not enough land.
What are we gonna do? But at a modern standpoint, we're like, oh, food is infinite, you know, like especially in the United States. So when we hear about stuff like this, it's insane. But
that quote was it rocked you to gore because like, deems like the population. Here's more worry about. Are they working at factories fine? The output's still up there, if not exceeding. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, but people are dying or cold or starving. We have incidents. But my output of the factories and workhouse, they're still up to speed. Like, yeah, that's all I care about.
Yeah, it's I pay my taxes. That should be enough. Whatever aid the government gives to poor people, you know.
And then they rebuttal, like, nobody's going to be able to afford to go to universities that your tax pay for.
Yeah, and it's... And sometimes it's just worse to be in those situations. Like it talked about poor houses back then, how it was almost worse to live there. It was like than to be outside and homeless because of how packed it was and how you were basically neglected because there's so many people that there wasn't enough to go around. You got a smallest portion of soup. And it was all very calculated and
very watered down. Maybe a little bit of bread, maybe a little bit of potato. It was a very starchy diet.
Yeah.
It was worse to be in that because there's so many people. It was like they were packed in like sardines. Some of a lot of them were like not dressed.
Yeah.
Barely any clothes. And that's horrible because they got like terms of like disease, dirt, sickness, illness. And then like, how do you expect anybody to live in that condition? Yeah. It's bizarre. And it's looking back now, especially when Tim was talking about this, going back into history, looking into these scenarios and digging a little bit deeper, we still don't know how many people actually died.
That is true. The record keeping was it didn't exist at the time, especially in Ireland.
Sporadic. I mean, before like only the famine,
wasn't it like, this might be not far enough back in history, but wasn't it like priests and stuff who would, that was back in medieval times, right? So
that was way after.
So this would be the Renaissance or the Industrial Revolution almost. So it would be, you'd think there would be more people documenting, like, oh, everyone's dying. But since there was the blight going on everywhere in the beginning, they were more focused on themselves. And it was, and Ireland just couldn't recover after.
Right. That's, and you had the infrastructure. You don't have roads to get to these people.
Yeah. So. They're isolated people in mm-hmm. these clumps out in the middle of nowhere. And you have to go over rough terrain, forge yeah. your own road, basically, cut and your own path.
You had to worry about people. So people would be dying. They'd be dying in ditches. They'd be dying outside of a road. Yeah. You have a lot of unmarked graves. And even, oh, I forgot the name of the cemetery. It was pretty prominent during that time, where they, for a long time, had a very good record of how many people died and how many were stored in that cemetery. Then they took on more people, unmarked graves, mass graves. And it's like, then you get the prompt, like, these souls are not going to be restful. I mean, then you have people, families who, associated people who die who are in these unmarked graves, upset because they can't find their family members.
Yeah.
That's
yeah, the still, superstition.
That's still to this that day.
That's very sad. It's, you don't even get your last burial rights, like right. the respect that you think you deserve.
A great, 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 great uncle could be, or grandfather, or whoever it could be, still be buried on the side of the road.
Yeah.
When
it comes to just disasters like that, like the Black Plague and things, you see the humanity just kind of leave because survival takes over. And so when you see mass graves and stuff, the respect of the person that you can give during a normal time is gone. You know, it's like we have to move on, and there's so much that we just have to do it as fast as possible, you know, and then so records were probably the last thing on their mind.
Right,
the
and you can judge a person's character by what situation you're in against someone who's like in a very low point in their life.
Yeah,
the British obviously didn't really show any remorse or emotion.
No, and they we learned recently that they continue not to. The government, the British government, is very pointed inward. It's trying to preserve itself. So right, whenever a bad situation happens, they will spin it that they didn't do anything wrong.
Right. They effectively crushed that whole population, that whole ethnicity, the whole country.
And the language, the culture.
And Gaelic, you can find maybe, I have a friend in Dublin currently, he was talking about, nobody knows Gaelic or can speak, not even like so proficiently. That entire language is almost eradicated, almost dead. And there's a very few people that can speak it. Yeah. You're still, I can sing it.
Yeah. The only Gaelic words I know are from Irish bar songs.
yes.
Like we were talking earlier of how the Irish deal with death. And this directly comes from the potato famine. How pubs became popular, how they drank it, and a Gaelic word for whiskey, which is very, you know, integral in Irish culture, mm-hmm. Ishkabaha, means water of life, and it was so integral to their life that you know, like that just showed the importance of it, that it was such an integral, like drinking and being merry is such an important part of life.
Yeah.
And they had to adapt that way because of the famine.
Unfortunately,
that's the saddest thing. And it lasts to today. It's crazy how that just never went away.
There's still like, what was it? I think Paddy's at one point had that slogan in Gaelic on one of their bottles.
Yeah,
well, I've got which whiskey it was. The white. It's been a while.
Yeah,
no. But some of them still do today. They still honor that. That, you know, tradition and that part of history,
yeah.
The water of life, English and in Gaelic. But no, they don't have that language anymore.
No, they don't.
It's
I tried to learn Scottish Gaelic once. You know that app Duolingo?
Yeah.
They've got it on there.
Do they?
And it is the funnest thing to listen to because the words are so close to English, but they're assigned to different things. Like the word bow means mm-hmm. cow instead of like a bow, an arrow. So there's a lot of words that sound English, but they're it's like a scrambled sentence because they mean other things.
Yeah.
And you'll listen to the talk, like cat means something else, you know, like, so you'll hear them say bow and cat and you're like, I think I know what they're saying. And then it's something totally different. And
cat
then Irish Gaelic is even more like crazy with it because it hits those like, that Irish slang, you know, how that that Irish accent, how difficult it can be to keep up with. That speed gets in the Gaelic too, and so then you're just talking to, like, imagine somebody from Mexico talking to someone from Spain. How, you know, there's that it doesn't mix. Yeah, it's Mexico's kind of like the American style of the modern,
a bit more simplified.
Yeah, it's more slang based. It's more you know, like, it adapted over time, while Spain is very historic. You know, they speak in a certain
very
way.
Very restrictive, very conservative in the way they speak.
In a very flowed kind of way, and a lot of times it's too fast. And you can see that with the Irish and the other, like, kind of Gaelic people. I think the only one who's got them outdone is the Welsh when it comes to how strange their language is. You know, you can't even...
imagine. It looks like one... extremely long word, and so many vowels and consonants.
No, it is. They don't they not separate their sentences? I think it's just like a string of letters.
But they can speak it. And they understand it. It's all. They have so much talent down. It's just like,
and so just imagine, because like me trying to learn Gaelic is like an Irish person right now trying to learn Gaelic. Because they didn't grow up with it.
No, they grew up in English.
It's just now being introduced back into schools. And some people are against it because they're saying, what's the point? But I think the preservation of a culture is important. So I can see why they're doing it. So after this class, do you think you'll be interested in traveling to Ireland? Studying abroad?
I am,
there?
Yes. I will probably travel, like that school trip, probably in the summer, more likely. I'm currently in the process of getting my passport in line. It's going to take about 3 months, so I'm excited.
Yeah, that's good.
I know a few people, not a whole lot, like one or two people that live in Ireland. I have one that lives in Northern Ireland, so I get all the business up there, and I got one that lives in Dublin, so it's pretty nice. Yeah. I do want to visit some of the castles there, some of the hillside scenery. Obviously, go to the pub culture, drinks, you know, food, especially dancing.
Yeah, definitely.
Pretty cool. And then just a change of scenery, like the weather's way different.
Yeah, the environment. That's obviously a big change.
Cleaner, I want to say.
Older.
Older, yeah.
That's what I've been to Europe, but I only went to Normandy, France, and I went to London. And it does feel old. Like, I don't know how to describe it. And it's just because I think so many people have been there that you can just see the wear. But
you can feel it.
You can feel the wear, the age. And then you see some building that's got moss growing on it, and everyone's like, that's normal. You're just like, all right, so this place has just never gotten out of the medieval time. You know,
it's still there. And it's like, wow. It's like almost like a time chamber.
Like, right? I visited Oxford, and you think of Oxford as a very prestigious school. But on the outside, it looks like a town that's overrun with, like, vines. Like, it's just covered in, like, leafy plants and moss. And they're just like, oh, yeah, it's a perfectly beautiful garden. You know,
it's still perfectly functional.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that's part of their culture as well. Quincy University is actually planning some trips to, like, London and stuff for the winter and for... the summer, and those are more tailored for, like, you take a class on London and then go. I wish that they had that for Ireland, because that would have been the perfect end of this class. It's so, because we've learned so much, and I feel like just having that experience of seeing it would really cement the things we've learned, like maybe going to Derry, going to, you know, the borders of... Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And
they'll probably go down south towards Dublin, go on the coastline and see how that goes.
Maybe go to the Jameson factories or whatever. No. You know, to really get into the culture. But, you know, it seems like there won't be any trips like that sent from Quincy anytime soon. But they do have connections with other schools that do send people to Ireland. Mm-hmm. So... I do recommend anybody who wants to study abroad to look at the opportunities that to where you can travel. You can check it out on Quincy University's website in the Quincy Center.
A few trips.
Yeah, you can talk to Kristen Leeson. She'll make sure you have enough credits and financial aid that you can go.
And they're not that expensive.
No, it's
fairly
6,000, I think, was the total cost, and I think you can get up to 2,000 in financial aid.
Right, and then like trips. I was going to go to Costa Rica before COVID happened. It was like $3,000.
All of those trips got canceled because of COVID. So yeah. I'm expecting a big bump.
Registration.
Because there's so many people who want to get out and experience life now and travel. So I see
revelation, like,
it's like finally go out.
I can go out. I'm going to do things I haven't been able to do before. So yeah, I recommend doing that. You get more well-rounded experience in your classes if you're doing any like art or music or even English literature classes or like British literature. If you're in a class that's focusing on literature from one country, go to that country.
Yeah,
that's the best way to learn.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's immersion is the only way. I think it's the catalyst of education, and mm-hmm. and it's so easy to get immersed in our classes that I could see us really just getting into the actual experience of going. So hopefully that is a plan in the future. And anybody who's wanting to do that, check out the QU website. If you are interested in listening to any more QU podcast, please check it out on the QU Media website, posted weekly. I've been Wyatt Randolph. This has been John Mayer. This has been QU podcast. Thank you very much.